The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everybody. This is Judge Greenberg. I'm joined by Judges Meredith and Falvey. We're convened by teleconference to consider arguments in the matter of Gardner Dickinson versus the Secretary, case number 19-4765. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance?
Douglas Rosinski for Kathy Gardner Dickinson.
And do you reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I reserve 10 minutes, please.
Thank you. Now, will counsel for the Secretary enter their appearance, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. Nick Esterman for the Secretary, and with me today is Megan Kroll, Deputy Chief Counsel.
And who will argue?
I will, Your Honor. Nick Esterman.
All right. Counsel for the appellant, please proceed. By the way I view it, and my colleagues may, to a greater or lesser extent, or emphasis, view the three issues as jurisdiction in the context of the Secretary's motion. Secondly, the merits of the case itself. Why should the remedy requested by the appellant be granted or not? And finally, the question of class action status. There may be other issues which occur to the court as a result of the argument. Be assured we have read the record and the submissions of all counsel. So you may proceed, Mr. Rosinski.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In the decision below, the Board of Veterans Appeals found that, quote, as the record contains no evidence contradicting the veteran's report, the board finds a remand is necessary to contact the United States Joint Services Record Research Center in an effort to verify the veteran's exposure to herbicide agents in Thailand. That is a decision that the board chairman refused to correct and that the secretary now defends that error against review. Mrs. Gardner-Dickinson challenges the court's current interpretation of its jurisdictional statute that allows such extreme miscarriages of justice to exist and propagate within the secretary's adjudication system while insulated from court review. As the court's jurisdiction is currently interpreted, this case will spin in the infamous hamster wheel until or unless the secretary decides to allow Mrs. Gardner-Dickinson access to this court. To be clear, Mrs. Gardner-Dickinson does not challenge the general requirement of a final decision or the longstanding definition of a final decision of the board. She, however, does challenge the court's position that there are no exceptions to the final decision rule, as it is inconsistent with the claimant's right of review by this court under the conditions specified in 38 U.S.C. 7261. In our view, the same issue of jurisdiction that is raised in the secretary's motion is the same as the issue within this petition, whether the court has jurisdiction to even consider the gross miscarriage of justice performed by the board in this matter. We fully recognize that current controlling law is that it would not be, and we are openly challenging the interpretation underlying that decision. Just to be clear, there are several board errors, not just the apparent gross misunderstanding of the evidentiary standard, but there is also no legal basis for JSRC to verify or have to verify herbicide exposure. This is not a PTSD case. It violates the uniformity of treatment discussed in Horn v. Shinseki. It violates the prohibition on development to deny in Hart v. Mansfield. It violates the regulation that, quote, development should not be undertaken when evidence present is sufficient for determination. In Douglas v. Shinseki, it violated 38 U.S.C. 7104D in that it did not issue an order with appropriate relief. And in sum, it's impossible for the appellant to ever prevail under this view of the law, because you can never get more favorable than no evidence contradicting the veteran. So therefore, it's unlawfully withheld fair adjudication, unreasonably delayed fair adjudication, and is an action or actions without observance of the procedure required by law. And I refer you to Horn v. Shinseki, which states, it's unclear how a remand would be anything other than yet another opportunity to generate more evidence to make up the shortfall on the contested issue. Indeed, there is no contested issue supporting this remand at all. The veteran should prevail, and that he did not is a miscarriage of justice that 38 U.S.C. 7261 is explicitly established to correct. Reconsideration of the court's current reading of 38 U.S.C. 7252 to include allowance of certain limited exceptions is needed, because the current no exceptions interpretations creates a jurisdictional gap, which the Federal Circuit described as appellate limbo, where the Secretary decides when or even whether a veteran's appeal can be heard by this court, even if the decision that placed the claimant in this limbo is based on the most egregious legal errors, and the Secretary is in unequivocal violation of 38 U.S.C. 7261. That is because, as the court's rulings in this case and in the related cases, that you're not allowed an appeal because it's not a quote-unquote final decision, but you're also prohibited from filing a successful petition because it's claimed that there's no exhaustion, you have alternate means of an appeal. This conflict defines appellate limbo. And more importantly, as a legal matter, it makes Section 7261 a nullity just when most needed, when there's a gross injustice, i.e. an error, open error of law, or a decision is withheld and unreasonably delayed because the claim is sent back on the hamster wheel.
This is Judge Greenberg. Will you take a few moments or sentences to address the class action issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The class action here is both protective and proactive. As goes all the way back to Monk, the Secretary has removed several cases by granting relief on the specific case when there's very important legal issues involved. And indeed, they did that in the companion case to this in Banyash. And also, on the merits of the class action, the class is superior here, most importantly, because yet another case to individually apply actually increases the issues with the spinning of the hamster wheel, because yet it's another law that the Secretary may or may not apply correctly individually, and then would just add to the numbers of remands and would just make the problem worse in our view. Obviously, any decision favorable in this matter would benefit to some degree, but we believe the class is very narrowly determined and actually could assist the court in the obvious issue of should you grant access or find your jurisdiction extended to such matters, in very carefully defining exactly which cases are potentially subject to review by the court under these conditions.
Well, just a minute. Again, Judge Greenberg here. What would you define in plain English what the class consists of if we were to grant or certify a class? is the class?
The class would be appellants who are unable to appeal or petition the court for relief from a specific board order, which is otherwise unappealable due to the current definition and interpretation of the court's jurisdiction, meaning essentially anyone who is stuck with being unable to either appeal or petition because of remand decisions that the court determines. And the standard I would propose is that if a court would reverse a board decision if it were final, then a remand based on that error would meet the standard. So in there would be a class definition much tighter than I just stated, but essentially it's people affected by improper remands satisfying a narrow standard established by the court.
All right. Have you concluded your argument, Mr. Rosinski?
No, sir. I would also like to address the issue of the analysis in Breeden. With all due respect, and with the benefit of hindsight, the Breeden court logic for rejecting the proposal to adopt the Federal Circuit's Williams exception is somewhat unclear and perhaps circular. In first acknowledging that the Federal Circuit found an exception to its finality requirement, and yet then finding this court could not adopt such exceptions because of an essentially identical finality requirement. And if I may, I'd like to read the quote. The Federal Circuit adopted an exception to the rule of finality with respect to its jurisdiction over decision of this court pursuant to 38 U.S.C. 7292A, which does not expressly limit its jurisdiction to the review of final decisions. However, as the Federal Circuit has held, this court's jurisdiction is limited to final decisions of the board. Thus, we are not at liberty to accept the appellant's invitation to exercise jurisdiction under an exception to the requirement of finality. That appears somewhat circular, or at least not somewhat illogical, in that it seems to state that both jurisdictional statutes leave it open, but because the Federal Circuit applied the same standard and found an exception, the Veterans Court could not find an exception. I don't believe the conclusion follows the logic, especially in light of this appellate limbo problem. It does not appear that the court adequately explained why exceptions to finality are not reasonable under 7252, but are reasonable not only under 7292 for the Federal Circuit, but the Supreme Court has found and identified a narrow class of collateral orders in the interest of achieving a healthy legal system allow exceptions even to the general finality rule in the for district courts and federal appellate courts.
What case is that?
I'm sorry?
What case is that?
Which case?
The Supreme Court you're
actually
citing.
It's U.S. v. Breeden, believe it or not. It's actually a criminal case, 366 F3rd 369 at 372.
Well, no, wait a minute. It can't be F3rd if it's a Supreme Court case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I will that is the Federal Circuit case that cited it. It's Cohen v. Beneficial Industries Loan Corporation, 337 U.S. 541.
All right. And what also, do you say the Supreme Court held?
They have upheld exceptions to the federal district court, federal appellate court rules for final decisions review by the federal appellate court. Similar to what the Federal Circuit has said for its jurisdiction.
This is Judge Falvey.
Are you asking us to overturn our Brady case?
In essence, yes. I think a reevaluation of the analysis and the law and recognition, which the Breeden court did not appear to recognize, that they were creating this jurisdictional gap. Also, they did not appear to analyze their interpretation under Brown v. Gardner.
Did you make this argument in your petition or, I guess, your motion for class certification or your response to the motion to dismiss?
I believe I argued that the petitioner has a clear and indisputable right to a writ because the interpretation of the jurisdiction did not, and I'm looking at page 8 just of the petition, the court determined that its jurisdiction does not include review of board remands as they are not final board decisions, citing Breeden, and then explain that the board's gross error is clear and that this needs that you should review the case.
Okay, let me ask you a question about those errors, those gross errors that you gave us a litany of. Obviously the secretary has had no opportunity yet to respond to the merits and obviously has not had a chance to address any perceived errors in the board decision. But isn't what you just described just a substitute for an appeal? And I guess, well, as a follow-up to that, kind of your appellate limbo argument, Banash got a completely favorable decision. I guess I don't quite see how Banash was stuck in appellate limbo, and here this case appears to be proceeding apace. You have an RO decision in March and now can appeal to the board, and ultimately you could appeal to us if you received an unfavorable board decision. How is this not just a substitute for appeal?
Your Honor, in Banash, we filed both an appeal and several petitions, but at the end, they granted Banyash under duress, as I would call it, because both of those were pending. After 20-something years, it suddenly kicked out without any additional action on our part, which is the trend. But they did not hear, and yes, they have issued another decision here since we filed the petition. The decision denied the case, denied the claim, without, for several reasons, it's deficient, but it's a typical hamster wheel decision. They didn't contact JSRC. They didn't add any evidence. And despite the board's clear finding that there's no contrary evidence, they still denied the case. So it's going
So have you appealed that to the board now?
We have not. The time hasn't run yet, and we're contemplating.
Well, if you're concerned with delay, it would seem to me that you would immediately appeal that. All the research you've done for this petition that would allow you to fairly quickly appeal it, I would think.
Well, we can appeal it, Your Honor, and then under normal circumstances, it's 3 to 5 more years to have it heard. This case, when a petition was filed, is based on the record
of the board. When it goes back to the board, doesn't it go back to its place in line?
Well, that's debatable, Your Honor. It is supposed to. I have many, many cases. I can provide you all the sites that you would like where it's taken years, even with the old numbers. But the issue here is that it should never have had to do this. And there is, again, appellate limbo. I did not create appellate limbo. The Federal Circuit identified appellate limbo as a potential issue. This is a pretty strong example of the extreme nature of some of the board remand bases. If they
sorry, Judge Falvey, go ahead.
You can go ahead.
This is Judge Meredith. I wanted to get back to, you just mentioned the Federal Circuit, and dial in on what you're contending is the basis for jurisdiction here. In your motion for panel, you said it was Section 7261 by itself could provide us with authority to address non-final board rulings. But now, have you backed away from that argument that 7261 alone could provide us with the authority to look at the non-final board decision?
No, Your Honor, I think that's an alternative argument, because if you do not agree or find that 7252 has allowable exceptions, which essentially every other court has found in the similar language, then 7261 must be self-actualizing, or else it could, as in this case, would and others.
How would you square that with the Federal Circuit holdings in Mayer and other cases that 7261 just sets out the scope of review for this court? It doesn't create jurisdiction itself, even if it didn't phrase it the same way as you did in your motion for panel. Has that not been precluded by the Federal Circuit of us using 7261 as an independent source of jurisdiction?
It's a bookend argument, Your Honor. Somewhere, our position is somewhere between 7252's interpretation and 7261's interpretation, Congress clearly intended for this court to be able to intercede, for example, on a case that was unquestionably delayed for insufficient reasons.
So
right now,
7252, the Federal Circuit has also spoken to that question as to whether a board remand is reviewable by this court, and if Kilpatrick and other cases have said it's not, how do you square your arguments now with what the Federal Circuit has said as to 7261 and 7252, and is there any relief that this court could provide in light of those cases?
I would submit that, first of all of those cases, well, Kilpatrick said they were not going to require this court to implement it. Howard identified that no one has raised the issue of this limbo, appellate limbo, and has not been addressed by the Federal Circuit. At some point, it will have to be, all these statutes will have to be squared. That's a basic tenet. It just, the issue has not been raised to there. It's an explicit footnote. This case raises that issue. Somehow, 7252 and 7261 have to be squared with each other to allow cases that fall, that are clearly in violation of the intent of 7261, to be reached by the court.
I think that's your time limit notification, but continue to complete your answer. And if my colleagues have any further questions at this point, we'll continue. Otherwise, we'll deal with it on your rebuttal. So finish
your answer. The answer to all of these questions, which are absolutely correct, the question is that all of these issues need to be squared, because this gap exists, and unless there is a basis for allowing the Secretary to do exactly what 7261 was put in to allow the court to stop, then they have to be squared. Either there's more jurisdiction under 7252 due to an exception, or 7261 has to be found to provide some jurisdiction.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do either of my colleagues have any further questions at this point? All right. Now we'll hear from the Secretary. Sorry?
This is Judge Meredith. Can I just ask one question about the class motion?
Go ahead.
Mr. Rinsky, the petitioner's class motion here was filed after our court had issued a number of decisions on class actions of Monk, Score, Godsey. The motion is fairly short. It's 6 pages long, and I don't believe it cited any legal authorities in support of the assertions that numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy have been satisfied. So even if we conclude that we had jurisdiction, do we have an obligation to address the substance of a class motion if we find that it was essentially unsupported?
Well, Your Honor, of course, you can always find a motion insufficient. as there is no explicit rule yet on how it, the exact amount or type of evidence to support, I'm not quite sure exactly how to provide, would have been able to provide more details. The evidence may be out there. The secretary would have the best information about remands and the number of remands, but the class certification is clearly within your jurisdiction to decide on whichever basis. I would submit that should you find that a class action would be in principle the best way to address this matter, that additional briefing or submittals could be provided.
To clarify, I didn't mean evidentiary support. I meant legal support for the motion, but Judge Greenberg, I'll pass it back to you.
All right. We'll hear from the secretary.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Fundamentally, petitioner asked the court to use the writ process, which is generally reserved for extraordinary circumstances, to review the basis of a board remand, vacate that preliminary order, and direct the board to re-adjudicate the claim on a factual record that is already found to be insufficient. However, this is contrary to the purpose of the All Writs Act, because it seeks to skip the administrative process and serve as a substitute for an actual appeal. And it ignores the court and the Federal Circuit's interpretation of this court's jurisdiction as barring review of remand orders. Petitioner seems to primarily argue in his pleadings that, or in her pleadings, that 7261 provides this court jurisdiction or authority to review a board remand in the context of a writ petition. However, the Federal Circuit has said repeatedly that 7261 merely lays out the scope of review and does not provide or expand jurisdiction. It merely provides the court with its powers to review a claim that falls within its jurisdiction. Similarly, the All Writs Act does not provide or expand jurisdiction where jurisdiction doesn't already exist. It merely aids the court in reviewing claims that fall within or potentially fall within the court's jurisdiction. And I'd also add that the class device does not provide jurisdiction where jurisdiction cannot be established for the class claimant. So all of those factors together fail to establish jurisdiction, and it would be a reason to act contrary to both this court and the Federal Circuit's understanding that 7252 limits the court's review to final board decisions and bars it from reviewing preliminary orders of the board in the form of non-final remand orders. But even if the court was to find that it had jurisdiction to review here, a writ would be inappropriate. It's a drastic remedy only reserved for extraordinary circumstances, and this is not such a case. Petitioners seeking to use the writ process as a substitute for an appeal, but the Federal Circuit and this court have understood that even if hardship or delay from unnecessary trials comes from pursuing the traditional appeals process, that is not a basis to use the writ process as a substitute for appeals. The petitioner has adequate means of other relief. A traditional appeal process will allow petitioner to raise the arguments that they've made in their petitions here with respect to Hart and Mariano, and as the court appears to have already recognized. And also add that there's no clear and undisputable right to a writ here. The conduct of the board was proper and ultimately does not fall within the jurisdiction of the court to review. I'd also like to speak to the petitioner's class motion. The burden is on the petitioner to satisfy all 23A elements and at least one 23B element. And the secretary submits that she has failed to do so here. There's two primary flaws in the class motion. One is the ascertainability of claimants within the class definition. Petitioner's motion lays it out as essentially all current or future remands that are not in accordance of law. I think the question is, how would you determine whether a remand is not in accordance of law? And that's where ascertainability comes in. It will require the court to engage in mini trials of each individual remand to determine whether that remand was not in accordance of law. an inquiry that would otherwise be foreign to this court, particularly when there is no record in the writ process for the court to obtain that review. I think superiority also comes into effect here, and the court has recently recognized a presumption against class actions. And fundamentally, what petitioner seems to be asking the court to do here is issue a precedential decision that says that the court has jurisdiction under 7261, which we submit that it does not, that governs all future remand. The precedential decision seems to be what petitioner is seeking here, not a class. And the precedential decision would seem to override any type of concerns about class application, and that would ultimately bind the agency going forward. If there are no questions.
Any questions, is, Judge Meredith?
This is Judge Meredith. Is it significant at all that the petitioner is saying that her ultimate goal here, is to receive a final board decision? Is that significant in terms of determining whether this is the writ would be an aid of our prospective jurisdiction, even if in the meanwhile it would require a review of a non-final board decision?
Your Honor, I don't think we're trying to say that the court doesn't have – the writ process doesn't provide prospective or potential jurisdiction. And I acknowledge that there seems to be some tension between that concept and the court's understanding of its jurisdiction under 7252 that it can't review non-final board decisions because a remand – would potentially lead to a final decision and under some construct of the procedural process. But I think the ultimate question in the writ process is whether the court's jurisdiction, statutory prescribed jurisdiction, is being frustrated by some type of action by the secretary. And that's not the case here. The board is remanding the claim for additional factual development to try to reach the decision. And in doing so is saying that it doesn't have enough information to reach that decision. So I think that's distinct here. And I'd also add that petitioner's not arguing necessarily, and not that this is specifically your question, but not arguing that there's a delay or a failure to act by the secretary here, which is kind of the traditional writ process that we see at the court. It's arguing that the secretary acted unlawfully. And I think that ultimately, when you reach the final decision of the board can kind of address those concerns given the court's precedent in Hart and Mariano and other cases.
This is Judge Greenberg. What happened here at counsel? Apparently, while this case was pending here, the remand was complete and the case was sent back to the board. Do we have that correct?
No, Your Honor. I admit the procedural history, I think, is a little complex, and unfortunately, because the veteran has passed away during the course of this petition, has complicated the issue a little bit. But my understanding is that the decision that was issued in March was a cause of death claim that was filed by the petitioner here and was denied because the veteran was not service-connected for any disability at the time of that claim. My understanding is the remand is still being worked on before the agency, and that has not been completed or returned to the board yet.
All right. Now, what's going to happen? As I understand it, the appellant says the board had everything it needed to make a decision before it remanded it back to what? The regional office for further development? And so what is it going to get that it didn't have before? We had an uncontested, as I understand it, statement that exposure in Thailand. What's it going to get on the remand? What is the board going to get that it doesn't already have or didn't already have?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that question is difficult to answer because we don't have an appellate record yet here. So the record is limited in terms of what led up to the board's remand and how it made that statement that petitioner is focusing on in the context of its remand, which is a preliminary order directing additional development. But, you know, I think when you – based on what
we
have
before
us –
I'm sorry to interrupt, but isn't isn't that why we're here as a court, to review the activities, even interim activities or interlocutory activities of the board to prevent this constant remand then back to the board and back again? Why can't we just cut right through it and say, what is it that the board didn't have that it's going to have that may change the outcome of this case?
Well, Your Honor, first I'd note that there's only been one remand in this case, so it hasn't been on the hamster wheel that petitioner is asserting. But I think if you look at the board's remand here, there's a number of efforts that the board was attempting to undertake, partially based on additional statements that the veteran at the time had made about temporary service elsewhere in Thailand. And ultimately, the analysis for establishing service connection based on presumption, or not, excuse me, based on herbicide exposure in Thailand, is it on a facts-bound basis, whether the veteran had some activities that were at the perimeter of bases where it was known to be herbicides were being sprayed. So the board was seeking confirmation that the veteran served at the bases that have been recognized for that, was seeking to develop that temporary duties assignment, and also ultimately a nexus opinion was going to be needed here and was seeking a nexus opinion in addition. So there was a number of deficiencies that the board found that it was seeking to develop, and I think that's well within the board's broad responsibility and abilities to develop evidence that it needs to reach a decision. And if the board hadn't developed that here or was instructed by the court that they couldn't develop that evidence, I think ultimately what we'd see here is a denial, and likely this would come back to the court again. So I think that's one of the reasons why the court has generally been reluctant based on its jurisdictional statute, but also from kind of engaging with the appeals, or excuse me, with the remand process, and what the board is trying to tell the agency it needs to issue its decision. And that's what's outlined in the remand here, and that's what we can understand based on this limited record.
All right. Anything further?
This is Judge Meredith. This is Judge Meredith. If I could, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked the petitioner about her class motion. It's 6 pages long and did not cite to any case law in support of assertions that numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy were satisfied. Even if we have jurisdiction to provide the relief that the petitioner is requesting, what is our obligation in terms of considering the substance of a class motion if we come to the conclusion that it was legally unsupported? What's the appropriate remedy in those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I think if ultimately the court finds that the petition's unsupported, it should deny that petition. The burden is ultimately on the petitioner to establish that that a writ is the appropriate procedural vehicle for this case to proceed, and we agree that that has not been the case here. And you know, ultimately,
I was talking about the class motion. Sorry.
Excuse me, if I misspoke, I meant the class motion. And you know, the court is required under the law to engage in a rigorous analysis of the 23A requirements. And I think if petitioner hasn't provided sufficient information for the court to do that, then I think the appropriate remedy would be to deny the motion. I think ultimately pleading is the responsibility of the moving party, and I think under the court's proposed rules, you know, there's a potentially for 30 pages of pleading available, and that the court is going to require petitioners to plead with specificity on all of the requirements here. And I do observe, I think, as a view, that there was about one sentence provided for each one of those factors, which also made it difficult for the secretary to engage in that analysis and respond.
Thank you.
Anything else, counsel?
I have a couple questions, Judge Greenberg.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for the clarification on the remand. I see that now. So your basic position is that Judge Greenberg was correct in his single judge decision and his reconsidered single judge decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can see Judge Greenberg was correct.
Yes, we believe Judge Greenberg is correct that
he's been waiting a long time to hear the secretary say that.
Well, I'm happy to provide that to him this morning.
So what are we to grant? If we agree with you, are we to grant the motion to dismiss, or are we to deny the petition?
Your Honor, I think I thought about this question a bit, and I think ultimately maybe the proper vehicle would be for the court to deny the petition based on a lack of jurisdiction if the court agrees with that, or deny the petition for failure to establishing an entitlement to a writ. And I think also by extension, denying the class motion. I think that would be the appropriate outcome here.
Thank you. No further questions.
Anything else? Counsel, anything else?
I would briefly conclude. We respectfully request that the court deny petitioner's petition and also deny the dependent class motion in this case. Thank you very much.
Any further questions from the court? Judge Meredith?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Right. Judge Falvey?
No, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Now we'll hear the rebuttal from counsel for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. The board did not say that it needed more evidence. What the board said was that it finds a remand necessary because there's no evidence contradicting the veteran's report, which included lay evidence indicating that his duties required him to work close to the perimeter during service. By the secretary's own administrative procedure, that's all that's required. And this court's case law makes clear lay evidence is sufficient. What the board is remanding for is improper. On the matter.
Let me just stop you. This is Judge Greenberg. I'm troubled by that. Isn't there a statutory obligation on the secretary to help the veteran perfect his case? And isn't there an obligation on the member of the board who hears the case, whether it's an actual hearing or considered with a – by the way, was there a hearing here where the testimony was taken?
No, Your Honor, there was declarations submitted.
All right, so that's a declaration under oath.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was not contradicted by anything from the secretary or from the department. Is that correct?
That's what the board found.
Right. So why doesn't that end the case? Sending it back – to wherever it was sent can only mean A, delay, or B, that they're seeking some contradictory or contravening evidence, and they're not permitted to do that, are they?
Well, Your Honor, the secretary has, and I've complained about this in other ancillary issues in other Thailand Agent Orange or herbicide cases, in that they insist on verifying lay evidence from veterans. And there is no requirement for that, quite the contrary.
Well, let's assume for the moment that there is a good faith basis for the secretary wanting to confirm that. Shouldn't that all have been done before? Isn't there an obligation under the regulations of the secretary interpreting the statute that the board member must make himself or herself knowledgeable about the record, knowledgeable about the file, knowledgeable about the veteran's case before they even have a hearing or consider the evidence? That's part of their responsibility. So if that's so, why didn't they get the information they are remanding before there ever was a determination?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I would just take a step even farther back and go, the law does not require and other law prohibits what the board did. But more importantly, if I may move on to the issue, to clarify again, we are seeking primarily a review of this court's interpretation of 7252 which holds there are no exceptions to a quote-unquote final board decision. The issue about 7261 is in conflict, the conflict created by this court's interpretation of 7252 and how it forecloses implementation of 72 or use of 7261 when the secretary, and we're not claiming evil here, when the secretary just delays or makes pretty clear errors, however you want to define that, 7261 is there to catch that. You heard the secretary's argument, which is essentially no one has you don't have jurisdiction to hear anyone argue that you might have jurisdiction. And that's the problem. That in a different way exactly defines the appellate limbo. We are not claiming that 7261 necessarily provides jurisdiction. We recognize the case law. But if 7252 has no exceptions, something has to provide authority and jurisdiction for this court to enforce 7261. For example, the clearest example is excessive delay. When it remands five or six times, when they have clear errors of law forcing remand, this case can remand around and around again, just like the last one in Banyash, and the secretary's argument's always the same. Well, we think we need something else. Well, if it's contrary to law, not in accordance with procedure, they can still do that. What would be the difference if the board said, we're remanding this because it's remand Tuesday, and you happen to be the 14th one today, and every 14th one on Tuesdays gets remanded? Would this court find that offensive enough to reach? According to the secretary, you couldn't. So this is the type of issue we have we are raising. If this is not extraordinary enough for a petition, it's exactly what we argued in principle. You can't file a petition, you can't file an appeal, and you can't even raise the issue of which one should you do.
Well, is this an analogy, this is Judge Greenberg again, to Justice Alito's analysis and going all the way back to Henderson? We have a statute there that says, shall be filed within 120 days. His analysis is shall doesn't necessarily mean shall. It's an important procedural rule, but it's not jurisdictional. Is that the analogous argument you're making here?
Well, that's analogous to and brings in the APA. And if you're going to bring in APA, then you bring in what the Supreme Court just found in the DACA decision just a few weeks ago, that there's a presumption of reviewability when a government action harms a citizen. And again, in the original Breeden decision, that was not apparently considered. It certainly wasn't discussed. And I think the direct route here and what we're asking for is for the court to review the basis in Breeden, the court's own language, of why it declined the invitation, is the term, to add any exception to its finality rule. That sets the court aside. I'm sorry, Your Honor. May I conclude?
Yes.
We're asking that you find jurisdiction under an exception to 7252 for definite and firm, when the court has a definite and firm conviction of a violation of 32 U.S.C. 7261-3D without observance of procedures required by law, and reverse to award based on the board's favorable factual finding of a lack of any evidence of record adverse to the claim. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions, Judge Meredith?
No, thank you.
Judge Falvey?
No, I do not, thanks.
Well, we thank both counsel for your excellent argument and your written submissions. The case is submitted.
The court is in recess.